I think Ozzy Osbourne looks cute on the cover of his album Bark at the Moon, I mean. Okay, on this album cover. It's nighttime, there's a full moon, and Ozzy is clearly supposed to be a werewolf. He's done up all pale, like some kind of Arctic werewolf, maybe? I don't know. They hired some monster makeup person, and Ozzy is baring his big fake fangs and mugging at the camera, and he looks cute, I think. I remember him often looking cute, or at least harmless. And I thought this way before Ozzy's current incarnation as kind of a cuddly, confused person, back when he was at the forefront of the satanic panic, back when certain people believed that rock stars, especially in the heavy metal oeuvre, were worshiping Satan, trying to indoctrinate youths into the ways of Satan, or were possibly just Satan himself taking over the bodies of rock stars, like Ozzy. People were scared of Ozzy Osbourne. There were stories about him. Most fake, many outlandish. He was on people's minds. And people like Ozzy would play into it, of course, to try to be scary, to be something dangerous and spooky that the kids would love and that would make parents upset and frightened because rock and roll, you know? But I think on the cover of Bark at the Moon, he just looks like he's playing dress up and doing it well and having fun. The reason I'm thinking about and talking about Ozzy and Bark at the Moon is that I Googled scary album covers, and this was one of the first to come up. And no, I'm not scared of it. It's not that scary. Iron Maiden's album Number of the Beast is on there too, which has Satan on the cover, along with Eddie, the kind of zombie monster mascot of Iron Maiden. And I don't know, if this kind of thing was scary when I was a kid, it's not anymore. It just looks like someone in shop class drawing Iron Maiden stuff, but, you know, the pinnacle of that art form. It's the platonic ideal of someone doodling in shop class. It looks like a comic book. It's even a little cute, too, because Satan is all red and has horns and he's holding a trident. It's funny. Not many of the album covers on this list are scary, really. Queen's News of the World is on here with the huge robot that has killed Queen, but the robot looks kind of benign and a little pensive, like he killed Queen accidentally and is just now realizing it. And, you know, industrial accidents are scary, but they're more unfortunate than terrifying. Black Sabbath's self-titled album is on here, and that has a picture of a kind of a witch, and it's a little scary, a bit, but I can get over it. It's No Nebraska. Nebraska by Bruce Springsteen, alone, without the E Street Band, 1982. No monsters or Satans or witches or robots on the cover. No picture of Bruce either. It's a black and white photo, and I'm moving from bottom to top here. We have a car dashboard, then a windshield wiper, a little bit of snow on there, and then we see a long, flat, straight road stretched out before us. Looks like some fences on either side. Above it, clouds. Portentous clouds. And red lettering, all caps, block letters on a black background. Bruce Springsteen, Nebraska. And it's scary. Because whatever it means, it's ominous. It indicates something scary happening or about to happen. My sister was a Springsteen fan, still is, I'm sure, loved The River, Bruce's last album before Nebraska, and so she bought Nebraska and didn't know quite what to make of it and told me that. I remember thinking it looked scary. I was 14 years old. Well, fast forward a whole bunch of years, and Nebraska is still scary, but for different reasons, because I've actually listened to it now 1,000 or 2,000 times since it came out. Okay, so right off the bat, title track, Nebraska. Bruce opens with, I saw her standing on her front lawn, just a twirling her baton. And like, uh-oh. Me and her went for a ride, sir. Oh no, what did you do on the ride? And why are you calling me sir? Who am I in this story? Finally, and 10 innocent people died. Okay, there it is. First verse, we're into murder. Multiple murder. Decuple murder. I had to look up the word decuple. Tenfold murder. The album never relents. Next song, Atlantic City. A chicken man gets blown up, and then his house gets blown up, and that's just the first two lines. It's a violent and intense and sad and beautiful album, Nebraska. It's one of the best albums of all the albums made. And it's scary, because to be able to write the songs, the painful, scary, tragic songs, takes a knowledge of a profound darkness, which means that Bruce Springsteen was in touch with a profound darkness. What I didn't know, until pretty recently, was that Bruce Springsteen had experienced some monumental depression in his life, that he wrote and recorded this album in a period of his life where the darkness wasn't just on the edge of town, it was everywhere. Nebraska is an album maybe about depression, maybe not about depression, but steeped in depression, soaked, marinated in the stuff. Sometimes when you get to know depression, when you shine a light on that darkness, there is a beauty that is revealed. You should listen to Nebraska. I mean, right now you're listening to this. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. I learned a lot about Nebraska and Springsteen from Warren Zanes. He's the author of a new book, Deliver Me From Nowhere, The Making of Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. Warren is the former guitarist for the band The Del Fuegos. He also has a PhD in visual and cultural studies, has been a professor at several universities, and was vice president of education and public programs for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum. Warren Zanes, welcome to Depression Mode.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so for people who follow this show closely but maybe don't follow Bruce as closely as they should, what is the Nebraska album?
The Nebraska album is Bruce Springsteen's sixth official release. It was the follow-up to The River. The River was his first number one album. It had his first top 10 single with Hungry Heart. And really, from a music business perspective, from the angle of a record label, a manager, what you do after your first number one record and your first top 10 single is you go up to the next level. That is a platform from which you can get to potentially superstardom. And what Springsteen did is he recorded an album that confused a lot of his listeners, that couldn't be played on FM rock radio next to, you know, records by Styx and Jay Giles Band. And then he went on to not promote the record, not do any interviews, and for the first time ever, not tour behind it. So if you could make a list of all the things that a record label would not want to hear from one of their artists, he pretty much checked every box. And so this is a record that when I first heard it in 1982, it felt like this act of defiance. It felt like this artist was kind of flying in the face of everything that the marketplace was asking of him. So even before Dropping the Needle, I loved him for that. It felt like punk rock to me. So I loved the defiance. But the truth was, I was also confused. And I still had that lingering question when I started this book. Why would an artist do that?
Right. And the recording of it was not exactly a big recording studio, highly produced affair.
No. So this, you know, the recording begins in 1981, and 2 years before that, the first home multi-track device was put on the market. So you're talking about a consumer device that is capable of multi-track recording, in this case, four-track recording. So you could buy a cassette at CVS, go home to your TAC 144 four-track recorder and do multi-track recording. You could lay down a guitar and a vocal. You could put percussion to it. You could sing a harmony. Basically, you could be a one-man band. So this was a novelty. But quality-wise, it was no comparison to the commercial recording studios that artists were using to make records.
And that Bruce himself had been using. He was famously fastidious and very fussy with everything that he had done before, and this was something else entirely.
Yeah, and he was also willing to spend his own money, which is, like, believe me, that's not every artist. But when he was making records like Darkness on the Edge of Town, at some point, a record label is going to say, we're not putting any more money into this. And Springsteen would spend his own money. And that's why at the start of the River Tour, again, his fifth record, here's an artist who's about to score his first number one album, who two records before was on the cover of Time and Newsweek, and he had $20,000 in the bank. And that's because he kept putting his money back into the process. So that four-track recorder looked like the solution to a pretty significant problem.
Right. What was going on in Springsteen's life when he made Nebraska? Where was he in his world?
Well, he comes off the tour for the River. During the tour, he had to move out of the farmhouse that he'd been in, where the band had rehearsed and had written albums. And so sight unseen, he got this new rental, this ranch house that was right on a reservoir in Colts Neck, New Jersey. And he came home to that, and he went into a kind of isolation. You know, Max Weinberg, the drummer in the E Street Band, said, you know, there was a period where we didn't even know where he lived. And so he goes into this kind of isolation, and, you know, whether he intended it or not, he's in the neighborhood of Freehold, the town he grew up in. And his mind takes him back to early childhood. You know, so we've heard a lot about his conflicted relationship with his father. This is a period when he kind of goes back before that to the time when he and his parents were living with his grandparents. And, you know, a lot of times when we talk about childhood trauma, it's about explicit abuse. It's physical abuse. It's sexual abuse. And he goes back to a childhood trauma that isn't that. But, you know, if I can give you a more long-winded answer here.
Yeah, please. You got to my question before I even got to it myself. So please continue.
Yeah. I mean, what happened in that home? You know, Bruce is so unguarded about this stuff, which I think is a major, I think it's brave, and I think it's important. But he talks about that home in terms of a kind of grief that isn't passing. It's a stuck grief. So his grandparents had a daughter who at age 6 was on her tricycle and was hit and killed by a truck on McLean Street in Freehold. And there was a picture of her on Virginia in this house where Springsteen was until about age 6. And it was like, he said that was the centerpiece of the house. And his grandparents, Virginia's parents, really, it's like they froze time and were just stuck in that loss. And when Bruce came along as the first grandchild, he was given this radical freedom. In like a misguided tribute to this daughter who was killed, they suspended all discipline with Bruce. He could stay up as late as he wanted. He could watch TV when he wanted. And, you know, like he said so openly in my interviews with him, it sounds like exactly what a kid would want, and it's exactly what they don't want. And, you know, so he's going back to this complicated situation. And, you know, in his words, again, he said it made me and it destroyed me. And so he comes back from the River Tour, and that's the past he goes into. And that's the kind of energy pocket. That's the emotional territory that fuels the Nebraska Project.
Was it, and I know that his father had dealt with depression a lot as well, and there were other mental health issues in the family. Did those feed into the making of Nebraska as well?
You know, I think those have come out elsewhere in his work. You know, I think if you experience a parent's depression, it's going to be in everything. But there was a real focus to that time with his grandparents. And you know, he's just coming into his 30s and feeling, you know, it was tremendous to sit and listen to him talk about it. But he just kind of lost the thread. He didn't know where he fit. And then when you layer on top of it, he was feeling disconnected from the people that he wrote about. After the river tour, he might have started with $20,000, but at the end, he had enough money to buy his first new car. And it was like, he didn't even know how to deal with that. It made him too different from the people that he wrote about and the people who were his people growing up. So there was this disconnection, and I think that just triggered this kind of, it was like a conversation with ghosts. You know that saying, if you deal with your past or your past deals with you. And I think that's the crossroads he was at, and he chose to deal with his past. And, you know, when I said, that's not the kind of thing you should do alone, he said, I didn't know that yet.
Right. But so he's, you know, he says very explicitly, and you talk about in the book, you talk with him about how this album is about his childhood trauma, but the songs are about state troopers and violence in Philadelphia and serial killers and these things that weren't part of his childhood.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's where, you know, there's a good section of the book where I talk about the influence of Flannery O'Connor's short stories on Bruce Springsteen in that period. And I think Nebraska is a really, you know, Bruce Springsteen is a remarkable writer if you stopped at his second record, you know, and then he keeps evolving. But with Nebraska, you know, part of the beauty of his long career is he keeps developing. With Nebraska, he's really thinking like a short story writer. The writing's getting more economical, but absolutely, these aren't stories of his childhood. He's not going into that model of the singer-songwriter experience. It's not the confessional model. This is like a short story writer. So much in the same way, you can't find Flannery O'Connor's memoir embedded in her short stories, but you know she's in there. Same thing with Nebraska. So that's why I say that early childhood was the fuel for Nebraska. The stories that he told, the violences in them, they were connected, but not literally.
Was the violence, and you talk about how the musician Patty Griffin notes how there's just violence all through the Nebraska record. Was that his way of processing what had happened to his aunt?
I don't think it was about what happened to his aunt. I think it was like violence was a way to talk about what happened to him. This is what I think. You know, and again, it's not to say that he experienced physical violence, but that radical freedom, which seemed beneficent, but left him having to figure out as a child what was too much. That's the adult's role, and it was given to him. And what that leads to is a kind of psychic violence, you know? So it's a very nuanced thing that he's getting into. But to me, he kind of makes that emotional violence literal in these stories.
There was a road trip after the album came out that seemed pretty pivotal. What was that trip?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll tell you, for this book, I feel Look, I couldn't have done it without interviewing Bruce. He's the spine of the book. And he's as good an interview as you're going to find, because he goes into it with his own curiosity. And nothing makes for a better interview. To be forthcoming, to be curious, to understand what the person conducting the interview is after, in this case, a book about Nebraska. You know, he was unguarded and he was inquisitive. So why did I get into it in the first place? When he wrote his memoir, I feel like he carved out the door for me. That door was like in the memoir. Nebraska goes by pretty quickly. It's just a few pages. And then he takes this road trip west that it's really the centerpiece of the book, of Bruce's memoir. And he's kind of describing a breakdown. He uses different language, but it's unambiguous. Like when that book came out, it was the headline. People were talking about Bruce and depression, about this incident after which his manager, John Landau, said, you need professional help. And he got it and started a kind of what he calls his odyssey, a therapeutic path that went into his, I think he's still on it. You know, I can't speak for that, but that's the impression I get of the man. But this trip west, seeing it coming right after Nebraska, knowing Nebraska was a journey into this childhood trauma, I didn't want to make a causal relationship, but I felt there's a connection. So that was the doorway he cut out for me to walk through. And then in allowing me to spend time with him, to ask all the questions I need to, that was the second gift. And I felt like, you know, he was pulled to this particular past. He was compelled to tell stories that were fueled by that past. And it got him to a place of just heightened vulnerability. And, you know, shit came apart. And there's a lag time before Born in the USA comes. And I felt, and it's not there in his memoir. And I thought, there's a bigger story here. I think one of the things that really strikes me is that a lot of people will make art about a kind of breakdown, but often after the fact. Nebraska's like this document from the heart of it, you know, from losing, he's like losing his basis, and he makes a record when he's there. And I felt like, even if I didn't get it intellectually in 1982, I'm like connecting with that. There's some part of me that like heard that record and I was my own kind of untethered. I was, you know, I was in my own trouble. And I think I was one of many, many people who felt vibrations coming from that recording that were really personal. You know, it took me years to get at it, but you know, there I am in my 50s having one of my most brutal years. You know, I lost a job of 10 years. The father that I never got to know died, meaning I wasn't ever going to get to know him. A marriage came apart. And there I am writing about this record, Nebraska. You know, I don't think it's a sheer coincidence.
You said he loses his basis. What do you mean loses his basis?
Meaning, you know, the last song on Nebraska is Reason to Believe. And, you know, Reason to Believe is a song that shows these little different scenes of people who have no reason to believe. People who have lost their basis for living, you know, their belief in institutions, whether it's family, religion, work, and don't have any answers for the question why. And everybody gets their turn with that. You don't have to be dealing with clinical depression to lose your basis, you know, to get to a place where it's not making sense and you're out of answers. And I think that he made a record from that place. Whether those songs are, you know, the songs don't have hope in them, but the act of making it and the act of putting it out there for people like me to connect with, that's where the hope is. So sometimes you got to measure it differently. You can't look at the songs and say that's where the hope is. You got to look at the act and you got to look at the transmission and go, that's where the hope is.
Well, that's where the defiance is. The existential crisis is occurring, and you step into the void and, you know, get out your four track and make an album anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to do this even though I'm not believing in anything right now. Like, that's some powerful stuff. I mean, a life in art is, you know, it's, I say it to my own kids, like, learn to write songs for an audience of one. You know, they don't have to be great. Learn this craft, because sometimes it might be the rope that you can grab onto. You know, I just think art, and I'm stating the obvious here, but I feel like it's an obvious that I don't mind saying over and over and over again, is like, learn some kind of art so that when you're in that place, when you're out of things to believe in, you've got that thing to hold on to. And the art, there's a good chance that it will do something for you that's just enough. You know, so don't think about it in terms of hit records and hit movies. Think about it in terms of saving your own ass.
More with Warren Zanes and with Bruce Springsteen, really, in just a moment. If you want to start a business and make your product or service available to everyone around the world, well, you can do that, because internet and websites, I bet you've heard of websites. The internet is full of websites. How am I going to build a website, though, you think? I'm not a dang web designer. I'm not a dang web developer. I'm no dang webmaster. Well, good news, I'm here to tell you that you are a dang all those things. You can build a website, an e-commerce store, a web presence, and it's not that hard thanks to Squarespace. I did it, so therefore you can do it too. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. They have this new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint, where you can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. You can accept credit cards, PayPal, Apple Pay. You can upload video content, organize your video library, showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even add a paywall and sell access to your video library. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Greatest Trek is the podcast for all your modern Star Trek needs. It's funny, informative, and now it's also timely.
That's because every Friday, right after the release of a new episode of Strange New Worlds, Picard, Lower Decks, Discovery, or Prodigy, we bring you a review of that episode.
There's some great new Star Trek coming up, and we're going to cover all of it.
You'll like our show because we're both former video producers, so we bring a lot of insight into the production and filmmaking aspects to these episodes.
And we also have a very refined sense of humor, so we make lots of delightful fart jokes along the way.
So come see why Greatest Trek is one of the most popular television recap podcasts on all of the internet.
Subscribe to Greatest Trek at MaximumFun.org or in the podcast app you're using right now.
Back with Warren Zanes, author of Deliver Me From Nowhere, The Making of Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. So I want to get back to you and what you mentioned about these crises that were happening while you were writing about Nebraska. What are the similarities and differences to what he was going through when he made Nebraska compared to what you were going through when you were writing about Nebraska?
Well, let me just say, like, there was no intention. I didn't think this thing through. I mean, you're guided by this stuff. If there wasn't a mystical component, it would be far less interesting. But I feel like any project I get into, I come out the other side going, oh, now I understand why.
Right.
I got into it.
Now the plot points line up, don't they?
Yeah. So pandemic was kind of mixed into it. But when I wrote two versions of this book, and the first one, without even thinking it, I went totally alone. I didn't share pages with my editor or my agent. I didn't share them with anyone. I wrote a book that's twice as long as the one that came out. I gave it to them, and they said, we don't think this is the book you meant to write. And, you know, and only then did I kind of go like, whoa, I didn't share it with anyone. I gave it to them, and they said, we don't think this is the book you meant to write. And, you know, and only then did I kind of go like, whoa, I didn't share it with anyone. Like, I've never done that. And I just did it without thinking. And I wrote way too much. and then I wrote a second book. And it got me to the book I needed to write. But it is, without intending it, without even thinking about it, I went into my own little Nebraska, and I was in a little bit of trouble, you know. But like, it was hard to understand when you have a father that you don't even know. So my father, you know, I probably have like 10 memories of meeting him, but he was out of the picture. Oh, by the time I was 2. So I have no memories of living with him. And then I lived like 30 minutes from him for years. And he just wasn't interested in having this relationship. And so I thought, you know, I'm better off without this guy. You know, he was married either 5 or 6 times, had kids in at least half of those marriages. But I'm like, you know, this didn't affect me. He's just an absence. He was never a presence. And then when that father dies, you come up against some, you know, just what I said earlier, like with his death, there was no chance you were ever going to know this guy. And something happens that's, I don't know, it affected me more than I thought it would. It was a destabilizing force. And then there was, you know, I don't know what was up. Why did I lose my job right at the same time? And I'd never lost a job. I'd left them, but why did that happen right when this father I didn't know died? And then a marriage falls apart. It was just, you know, everybody gets their turn in the deep shit. That was my deep shit. And then I write a book about Nebraska. And look, it was, in the end, I think it did me a lot of good. And I think I was helped by the story of an artist who made a record in a very dark place. Again, like I was saying about, that doesn't surprise me, but I only saw it in retrospect.
What was the sequence of events with job loss, death of father, end of marriage, and deciding to write about Nebraska? Where did the decision to make a book about this album, of all things you could write about, where did that fit in?
I think you just named the sequence.
Okay.
But I honestly, I didn't think about what was going on with me when I said, I want to write about this. I was really dealing with lingering questions. And if I were to boil them down, one was, why do I connect with these desperate people in the way that I do? So there's the personal layer, which I knew wouldn't be in the book, but it might fuel it. And then the other was still that same question. why would a guy at the top of his game do something that from afar looks like career self-sabotage? Why would he do that? Because I looked at it and I thought, man, if I was coming off a number one album and a top 10 single, I'd go for the gold. Why did that guy do something that's so out of line with human behavior? Something was driving him. So, you know, I wanted that answer. I wanted to find out. These guys are so interesting to me, who come from lower working class backgrounds and then find these lives that look 100% different from what they come from. I think that's an intense experience. And for the ones who survive it, I think they're really deep people. And I wanted to go into that story and look at another one of these guys.
Yeah. So Springsteen goes into this album. I mean, he goes into making some demos that eventually became the album. And then he makes the album. Then he has, Shit Falls Apart. Would shit have fallen apart with or without this album? Or was this did this force everything into a crisis? Did it screw him up further?
I wouldn't say screwed him up further, but I just think there's no way going into that territory of his childhood that it didn't like unmoor him further. You know, when people come into that moment in their life where they're ready to deal with their past before it deals with them, it's probably going to get darker before it gets lighter. They're gonna come into some things. Hopefully they're with a good and able therapist or a team of them. You know, like we really need help. But I just think it gets, the seas get rougher before they again get calm. And so that's what I was seeing. Like if he went into Nebraska, and these are the conversations I had with him, and I feel like he confirmed this. Like, you can't make it a strict causal relationship, but come on, if you go to that place, it's going to be harder. And then you're going to start to put things together and rebuild. And I felt like there was something about looking at Nebraska and Born in the USA and going, there's a big dip down between those things. And then he returns. And that's where I got obsessed with this Homer's Odyssey as a story that had that same dip down before the return of the hero in Odysseus. And I really wanted, in sitting with Bruce, I really wanted to, with him, map that story onto his own in that period of his life.
Yeah, explain that connection, because I know that really resonated with him a lot too when you brought that up.
The problem with it is it's really hard to do in a short form. But,
sure.
You know, the story of the Odyssey begins when Odysseus tricks the Cyclops to get out of his cave. The Cyclops is big. He's a brute. He can gobble men up. And somehow Odysseus has to get out of the cave, and he tricks the Cyclops by saying, "I'm nobody." And they gouge out the eye of the Cyclops. And when the Cyclops yells for help, the other Cyclops say, "Who did this?" And he says, "Nobody did this. Nobody did this." So Odysseus uses his cunning to get out of the cave. But what he does is he's nobody. But then Odysseus, leaving the island of the Cyclops, can't help himself. And in a moment of hubris, a fit of ego, he says, "It is I, Odysseus." And the moment he says that he stops being nobody, he's declared himself The Cyclops' father, Poseidon, hears that and goes, I'm going to fuck this guy up. And Odysseus can't get home. You know, he goes through all these trials and, you know, Poseidon not letting him get home to his family is a big part of the story of the Odyssey. So the way Odysseus finally gets home to recover his position as a hero, his position as a husband, his position as a father, is to return as nobody. He gets another shot at being nobody. He returns to his home, which is filled with suitors, men who want his wife's hand, who want his son's power, and he returns as a beggar, invisible, nobody, once again. And this time he gets it right. He's not going to go, it is I, Odysseus, and let the suitors kill him off. He remains nobody, and that's how he regains his position. I felt like Nebraska was Springsteen being nobody so that he could return in Born in the USA as the hero. But you got to be able to be and sustain being nobody. And it just explains so many things to me. And I wanted to kind of tell a short version of that story to Springsteen and see him hearing that. And it could have gone either way. And in the middle of it, he says, go on, meaning keep telling that story. And I was like, man, that's like top five moments in my working life. Like, I felt like my theory held some water and he was telling me to go with it. It's funny what gets you. That one gets me. In part because I think The Odyssey is the best self-help book ever written. You know,
really?
I've learned so much from it. Like, I found an audiobook version for young readers that I play for my sons when they were really young because I felt like I needed it as a reference for them, to parent them. You know, it was a book that parented me. You know, like, I think the best, you know, I started going to a self-help book section hoping nobody caught me there, and now I go there proudly. But the best self-help books are the ones that parent you. They give you something you didn't get when you were growing up. And there are lots of us who didn't get everything we needed. And so a good book can provide some of that, not the flesh contact, but the guidance. And Homer's Odyssey gives you all these things, like the temptations of ego, the temptations of the flesh, greed. And you get to watch Odysseus find his way to this absolute simplicity of being nobody. And, you know, I'm a member of 29 years clean and sober. And Alcoholics Anonymous, if I can talk about it for a minute, like, everybody thinks anonymous means you don't tell people that you go there and you don't tell people who else is there. I don't think that's the heart of it. I think the heart of it is, can you be in the room and be nobody? Can you be without the trappings of ego? Can you be without the resume? Can you be without your successes, you know, your physique? Can you be without all that stuff and still be in that room comfortably? That part of Anonymous, I feel like the Odyssey covers that. Like, the people I look to and admire are capable of being anonymous in the middle of the room. And I looked at Springsteen making Nebraska, and I'm like, that's kind of as anonymous as a rock star can get. in putting out an official release. It just, it still mesmerizes me as a choice. And the Odyssey helped me get to that. And, you know, so thank you for letting me go into it.
there's a lot that could be substituted with the Odyssey in Nebraska, it sounds like. It sounds like it, you know, the shedding off of the E Street Band and the arena tours and everything else to sit in this little bedroom and make this album and be nobody.
Yeah, to be nobody and to be so completely alone. Odysseus also in being and returning home as that beggar, as nobody, he's alone. You know, he's alone in his own home. And to be alone in your own home, you have to have this kind of strength that is the type of strength that carries you through anything. You know, and he finally gets to it. Odysseus had a lot of strength 20 years before, you know, when the Trojan War starts. He's a hero. He's known for his strengths. He's known for his cunning. But it wasn't enough. He needed to be able to be without any of the moorings. You know, and in the case of Springsteen, it was the moorings of band. It was the moorings of, you know, being the star on the record cover. He stripped so much back.
Was him making Nebraska a healthy and therapeutic thing? And was you writing about Nebraska, writing Deliver Me From Nowhere, a therapeutic thing? Was it a moment of being in the depths that was necessary to get to a healthier, happier place?
Well, for me, I have a therapist. I've got a long-term therapist. I'm in recovery. I have a sponsor I talk to. Like, I'm really, like, I got a lot of support around me. So when I had my experience, and, you know, it was particularly the loss of that marriage, like, really, I mean, I was down the well. But I had a lot of people who were looking down into that well with flashlights, keeping an eye on me. I feel like when Bruce made Nebraska, you know, that's why I asked him that question. Like, you know, you're not supposed to do that alone. He was like, I didn't know that yet. You know, like I said to you already, I don't think he would do it the same way again, knowing what he knows now. You know, he got to the end of that road trip and John Landau said, I think you need professional help. And he got it. Like, even our heroes. And then this is like, look, I'm a professor. I look into my classroom and post-pandemic, I see students, many more students dealing with panic attacks, missing more classes. Like, there's a mental health crisis that's underway and underreported. And when someone like Bruce Springsteen steps up, as he did in his memoir, and talks about his own mental health, I hope he's setting a new standard for others to do the same. You know, but there's this old thing where we want our heroes to just show up as heroes. And what we actually need is our heroes to show up as humans and to expose vulnerabilities, to expose challenges. And, you know, he's an inspiring model in that respect. But I wouldn't draw a parallel between my Nebraska and his because I had so much help.
Right, right. What's a song on Nebraska that you keep going back to?
Well, Highway Patrolman. Boy, I'll tell you something, like doing interviews for this book, like it's like pokes at me a lot and often because, I mean, and having heard from so many people who love Nebraska, I know I'm far from alone in this, but the stuff is, you know, I can barely talk about my father's house. It's hard to talk about Mansion on the Hill. It's Highway Patrolman, like, gets me, like, still. You know, I've got a brother, and, you know, we've got a pretty good relationship today. But, you know, you kind of need a father to help you understand how to be brothers, and we didn't have that. And, you know, in my home, my brother was kind of elevated to, well, he's the oldest male. He must be the man of the house. And that's the wild fucking West. And it was hard for us to be brothers in the wake of that. And, you know, Highway Patrolman, when he lets his brother go, when he suspends the power of the law to honor that brother relationship. God, you know, I was talking to Dave Alvin, who was in the Blasters and has made a lot of great solo records. And he was in a band with his brother. And man, when we were talking about Highway Patrolman, as two guys who were in bands with their brothers, were like, how did Bruce Springsteen get to those truths without having had the experience we did? Like, that is a writer's gift. You know, that's a kind of sensitivity that, you know, we just felt a kind of awe because we just felt ourselves in that song. So that's a long answer.
No, that's a great answer.
Oof.
That's the one that I keep coming back to as well. And I think, I mean, in my case, it's because I had a brother who got into a lot of trouble, and I really have to dole that song out carefully.
It's such a complicated ending.
It is.
Because there's a couple things happening. You know, one of them is like this expression of love over the law. Like, I'm going to go with love and let you go. But at the same time, he's detaching. Like,
it's loss as well.
Saving you. Yeah. It's so, and they're both resonating. Without him spelling that out, like Springsteen as a songwriter knows like how much he needs to leave for the listener and how much he needs to bring to the listener. But that moment is like, you know, the Highway Patrolman has, you know, they say like, you know, you got to put on your air mask before you help the other person on the plane. He can't help his brother if he can't first help himself. And so he's letting him go, but he knows what he's letting him go into. The guy's, it's not good. It's not freedom, you know, but he's got to detach. At a certain point, you've got to detach.
Yeah, yeah. That makes me wonder, though, does he ultimately, he says in the song, man turns his back on his brother, that man ain't no good. Does he turn his back on Frankie at the end of the song?
You know, it's no and yes.
Okay.
You know, so it's like that. That's the thing. Like, you listen to a song like that, you get to the end, you have to go back to the beginning.
Mm.
So that line that you just shared can resonate differently.
Right.
So you get to the end like, well, is that what he did? Is he singing that line in the story because he's so conflicted over what he did? The sophistication of the writing is, you know, give me, as a songwriter, give me one Highway Patrolman, and I promise I'll retire.
I want to take a moment to thank our listeners for sticking around for the granular analysis of Springsteen lyrics portion of this interview. And we didn't even get into why having blown up a chicken man, one needs to blow up his house too. It seems like overkill to me. I don't know. The book is Deliver Me From Nowhere, The Making of Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. The author is Warren Zanes. Warren, thanks.
That was a lot of fun for me. Thank you.
You can find out more about Warren Zanes at warren-zanes.com. Check out his biography of Tom Petty also if you have a chance. Warren goes deep with that subject. It's very interesting and very moving. Laura House and a meditation moment right after the break.
Hey there, this is Drea Clark.
This is Alonzo Duralde.
And this is Sparta!
Iffy.
Listen, I got 300 on the brain. We just watched the movie 300 in honor of our 300th episode of Maximum Film.
That's right. And to celebrate this major milestone, we brought back original co-hosts Ricky Carmona and April Wolf.
But just for this one episode, right?
Oh, Iffy, you know we could never replace you.
Some of the voices have changed over the years. Heck, the name of the show has changed too. But through it all, Maximum Film remains
the movie podcast that isn't just a bunch of straight white guys. Deal with it.
Find this and all 300 episodes of Maximum Film anytime on MaximumFun.org.
Well, let's have a meditation moment, shall we? Let's collect our minds and our breath a little bit with Laura House. She's the co-host of the Tiny Victories podcast, and she joins us now. Hi, Laura.
Hi, John. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to hear you. Good to know that your lungs are functioning.
Yes, absolutely. We talk sometimes about meditation, how to do it, and
right.
We walk through it. We don't talk much about when to do it.
Ooh.
And I thought I'd throw that out there.
Okay.
The way we do it here, which is great, you can meditate anytime. We do a simple mindfulness meditation. But if you want to make it a habit, it's good to do, like, wake up, meditate before you hit the world, before email. Do the meditation before you open your email, grab your phone, let the world attack your brain.
Yeah, don't dive into the Wordle straight away.
Exactly. Don't get that stressful, like, oh, what if I don't get it? Now my whole day is ruined. But then you right. can also do it anytime, like we can do now. So if you're in a safe spot where you can close your eyes, you can do that. And just get comfortable wherever you're seated. Close your eyes.
Feet on the floor.
You can feet on the floor. You can want your back supported, head upright. And then just breathe. So the first thing is, we're not looking for anything magical. Just close your eyes. Just breathe. And feel yourself breathe. Like, give your breathing a little attention. So that could be touching your stomach or even just internally in your mind's eye. And you're probably also having thoughts. Totally normal. You can have thoughts. They're going to be there. But you're just giving some attention to your breathing. And just sort of let everything go. All your to-do lists. And you can go ahead and open your eyes. It's just a little respite, pulling over the car of your brain.
That's right. And possibly pulling over the car of your car in order to in order to do that.
A definite possibility.
Oh, it's just a little pause in the day. And it's what do they say about, was it Pepsi Cola, the pause that refreshes?
I don't recall.
I'm not sure. Pepsi doesn't need to be an integral part of your meditation.
Yeah. Remember when they started putting lemon in it?
Listen. Oh, yeah. Right. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Laura House can be found at laurahouse.com and on the Tiny Victories podcast. Laura, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
If people become members of Depression Mode, if people donate, then we can keep having a show. If not, then we can't have a show anymore. We like having a show. We think you like listening to it. So we need to hear from you. If you've already donated, we really appreciate it. Thank you. You're making it happen. If you haven't yet donated, it's easy to do. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join. Find a level that works for you and select Depression Mode from the list of shows. You can check out our merchandise store. We have all sorts of wonderful gifts, all sorts of I'm glad you're here type of merchandise on all sorts of things available there, including we have some Depression Mode sweatpants that are selling really well. People love the sweatpants, you know, because what's depression without sweatpants, I say. That's at maxfunstore.com. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available 24/7 for free in the United States by calling 988. The Crisis Text Line, also free and always available. Text the word HOME to 741-741. Our Instagram and Twitter are both at DepreshPod. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. Lots of good conversation and support happening there. People helping one another out. It's very inspirational. Our Depression Mode newsletter is on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at John Moe. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. Hi, credits listeners. My wife and I went to see Bruce Springsteen one time, many years ago. The only seats we could get were behind the stage, so we had to kind of wait for him to spin around and play to us, which he did plenty of times. But mostly throughout the concert, the only thing we could see was Bruce's ass. Mrs. Moe reported that this was, in fact, just fine with her. Depression Mode is made possible by your contributions. The show is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson, and we get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings. And I'd like to welcome Clara Flesher to our show. She is our new intern. Clara, welcome aboard.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hey, this is Amy from Rockville, Maryland, and I want you to know that your worst moments do not define you.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.